Hello and welcome to this week's edition of The Front Page. It's election week in Britain and the Labour Party is set to sweep to a landslide victory, remaking the political picture of the nation. But what does this mean for the sport of horse racing? The election comes at a point of profound crisis for the sport. Last week, the BHA released the latest betting turnover figures, which showed a 5.9% decline in turnover in the first quarter of the year. This represented a drop in betting turnover online only of around 130 million, and if extrapolated to the whole year, would be a decline of around 500 million. Indeed, this follows on from consistent losses since 2022 and would bring the decline in online turnover on horse racing to £1.4 billion in 2 years at a time when inflation has been running often above 10%. What does this all mean for racing and how does racing tackle its challenges? To address these important questions, I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by our industry editor, Bill Barber. Welcome, Bill.
Good morning.
And reporter, Jonathan Harden. Jonathan.
Morning, Tom.
We are going to dive straight into those alarming figures released by the BHA, illustrating the continued pressure on racing's finances. Bill, we have seen an almost 6% drop in turnover in the first quarter, following on from a 9% decline in 22-23. What lies behind this continued pressure on racing's turnover?
Well, I suppose there's a number of factors. It might not surprise regular readers of the Racing Post, and especially my stories, that affordability checks and the restrictions placed on punters through that will be a major cause. There's cost of living as well, I suppose, and issues around the competitiveness of racing. But the figures are pretty scary. They've been sort of flagged up by the levy board has been talking about. We're seeing turnover consistently coming down. Mm. The levy is being sort of kept up by profit margins at bookmakers, but where it will really hit racing hard is through the media rights deals, which are based on turnover. So if turnover's down 5.9%, that's a lot less money coming into racecourse coffers.
Yeah, so let's just break down how racing's finances work. We have the levy, which is obviously a sort of a tax on betting profits, which as long as the profits hold up, will hold up itself. But then we have media rights deals, which are often based on turnover, and those are feeling the pressure. And these are really critical funding streams for horse racing.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, a lot of people sort of concentrate on the levy, but media rights has overtaken that to a great extent. I mean, the levy has been performing quite well, surprisingly, given everything. There's been, I think, the most recent one brought in about 100 million plus, but the overall income from betting is supposedly around 350 million. Some of that will be sponsorship, but the vast majority of that 250 million pound difference is from media rights. So, as you say, I think most of the deals are based on turnover now. So if turnover falls, racing's income falls.
So for those of our viewers who don't spend hours delving through Gambling Commission industry statistics and such like, let's just paint a picture of what's happened over the last few years to racing's turnover. We obviously saw a massive shock to it during COVID, but other than that, if you go back over the last sort of 6-7 years, what you see is a steady increase in turnover on horse racing, around about keeping pace with inflation. And then suddenly in 2022, as affordability checks come in full force, it just nosedives. And it looks like what's happening now is that decline is continuing.
Absolutely. And as you say, it had been, if you bring inflation into account as well, it makes the situation even worse. So, I mean, racing is looking to try and arrest this decline, but these figures, which are sort of the initial figures from the efforts that they've been making, they demonstrate that there's a lot of work to do.
And if we consider that perhaps £1.4 billion at least has disappeared from the horse racing market, it could obviously be significantly more than that if you account for inflation. Where do we think that's gone? Some of it will have just stopped, but do we think some of it has also gone to the black market?
Well, I mean, certainly, obviously, it's given the nature of the black market, it's difficult to put a figure on it. But anecdotally, racing is unfortunately financed. A lot of the money from racing comes from a relatively small number of punters, and if some of that relatively small number aren't able to get their bets on, they'll either stop, or they'll find another method to do that through either offshore bookmakers or these sort of shadowy WhatsApp operators.
You're a informed and connected individual. Let's be honest, nobody who spends any time in racing is hearing anything other than the fact that these big punters have gone to the black market.
Certainly, yes. I mean, if you listen to, say, Martin Cruddas, the chief executive at Arena Racing Company, who will have a lot of these figures at his fingertips. Mm. He certainly appears to be no doubt that, you know, the black market is sucking away a lot of this income from racing.
John, all of this comes at a time of course, as I mentioned, high inflation. That doesn't just mean that, you know, racing's income is failing to track inflation. It also means that it's failing to account for the rise in costs, which basically impacts every part of the sport. So the race courses have higher costs, but so do trainers, owners. So the entire sort of economics of the game are under enormous stress.
Yeah, one side of the graph's going down and the other's going up, and as you can see, it's a long way off tallying, and it's become a bit of a cliche, but it is a fragile ecosystem, racing, and when betting turnover drops, it might feel like something that happens further up the chain, but very quickly you'll realise lower down, and you'll see it in prize money and the returns, that it will have a huge impact, and relative to the costs alongside that, those margins for trainers, for anyone who derives their living from the sport, only get slimmer.
We haven't really seen a huge impact on prize money today. The Jockey Club made some limited prize money cuts early in the year after a poor Cheltenham Festival, and we'll come on to that in a second. However, broadly, prize money has held up. The fear has to be that prize money cannot defy gravity indefinitely, and at some point it is going to come down, and that is when the pressure on racing, and indeed the pressure that's been building for more than 2 years now, suddenly becomes blindingly apparent.
Yeah, it feels as though we're getting towards a tipping point, really, and I think a lot of those prize money commitments have been the larger racecourses who derive more income from the spectacle, from attendances and things, and perhaps less reliant on the betting turnover or the income derived from betting turnover. I think it's those racecourses that rely quite heavily on media rights that will have to tighten their purse strings a little bit in the future as a logical knock-on effect. Mm. And I'm also thinking if racing comes to a point where it is no longer as attractive to bookmakers, they might potentially look at investing in other products that have a better return for them. Logically,
I think,
that's how
I think we're already seeing a reduction in the offers that bookmakers put around horse racing, best odds guarantees, of course, the much mourned offer that used to be ubiquitous but now is increasingly restricted. Pricing is another thing that we're going to see pressure on. So the bookmakers want to preserve their profit margin on declining turnover. The only way to do that is to increase margins, reduce marketing.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's keeping the levy up. But at some point, that can't continue, you wouldn't have thought. And that will add to the pressure on racing's finances and on prize money.
The BHA release was put out to mark the first quarter of its industry strategy and Premier Racing initiative. Were there any rays of light?
Well, I suppose there were a couple of things that were in there that you could take as positives. Bookmakers reporting that the number of active bettors is up, which is good. And also, Sunday racing has been a bugbear for the sport for quite some time. The betting turnover for sort of the Sunday meetings, the Premier Sunday meetings, was up 21%. So, there are some positives there, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And in some of the other KPIs, sort of the flat Premier product, if I can use that word, which will annoy a lot of people, seems to be performing reasonably well, which is might surprise some people, given that Premier Racing hasn't exactly started with a blaze of publicity or promotion.
I was struck by the fact that when they noted the turnover decline on individual segments, it was Premier Racing 2.7% decline, so outperforming the rest of the product, but not positively. And core, which is what they call everything else, at 5.2%. But both of those figures crucially stripped out the Cheltenham Festival. Mm. And of course, if we remember the headline decline is 5.9%, that then leaves you with the understanding that the decline on Cheltenham was greater than 5.9%, which is quite extraordinary when we consider that Cheltenham Festival is the pinnacle, not just of the sport, but also betting interest in the sport. So you have this flagship jewel in the crown, which is performing worse than the rest of the racing product as a whole.
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you look over the years, if you look at the sort of the bookmaker figures for the biggest betting races of the year, I mean, people are amazed to see like the Fox Hunters Chase is amongst the sort of the top ten races, which is because it's the race after the Gold Cup, and it's because the Cheltenham Festival is such a huge betting event. And if the Cheltenham Festival isn't performing well, that has a big sort of knock-on effect for the overall figures.
John, we've known that these problems are building for racing for some time now. We've been talking about them on this programme since we launched. We've been talking about them in the Racing Post for years. The sport has put in place some initiatives to try and address this, of which Premier Racing is the highest profile. I think, again, returning to a favourite topic of this show, we would have to assess those initiatives as being limited in impact at best.
It's frustrating for me because when this premierisation concept was launched and it was sort of sold as a brave new dawn, and I did get swept up in it. You know, I felt like it was perfectly logical to showcase the best racing and to pump money in, and to that would create a virtuous circle. I really bought into the idea, and it just has been almost half committed to. They've done enough and they've got the KPIs and it's all very logical and everything else, but it just felt like the softest of soft launches. Mm. And I just wonder, without a concerted effort to really push it, A, how useful the data will be at the end of the trial period, and B, just, you know, how can you expect something without to succeed if you're not going to go 100% behind it? And that might be a little bit naive to think you go in two-footed on something, but it feels as though we are in those kind of terms where it is going to require something drastic to turn the ship around.
And then you look at the prospects of that happening and you think, Jesus, not great, because we have Racing's marketing arm, which one would assume would be responsible for promoting and selling the sport as a whole and the Premier Racing concept as a new idea, doesn't have a chief executive. It has a tiny budget. It failed to get additional funding from the levy board signed off, presumably because, point one, it doesn't have a leader. The BHA has an outgoing chief executive who's going to sort of, you know, stick around for another 6 months doing, one would assume, not a great deal, because with the best will in the world, an outgoing leader never has the authority that an incoming or incumbent leader has. The biggest racecourse group also has an outgoing leader. The chair of the sport is going to be leaving by the second half of next year. And that's not even touching the entire spread of senior leadership exits in the sport. I mean, racing has a catastrophic leadership vacuum at the worst possible time, having totally fudged its industry strategy and its great new idea of Premier Racing. The prospects for the sport right now are not looking great.
It almost makes you think they know something we don't know. There's been such an exodus that you're almost looking around and thinking, where did everybody go at a time when you do need some pretty serious and decisive leadership? And I think that's why it's always fascinated me, that sort of yearning for a Barry Hearn type figure, because there's just this desire for somebody who can just grab it by the horns and just do something decisively and fully commit and kind of get stuck in. It's just crying out for somebody to take control of it, because it does feel like we're sort of, well, we're careering towards a cliff edge.
Well, let's move on from this topic, because clearly the sport is crying out for change and strong leadership, and perhaps the country is as well. Keir Starmer poised to become the next Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. John, you've been reporting on it. You've got a piece in today's newspaper looking at what the election is likely to bring for racing, i.e. all the different MPs that represent racecourses or who have been key players around representing racing's interests in Parliament or being participants in the gambling regulation debate. What's the picture? What are we going to see on Thursday evening?
Well, it's broadly mirrors what we're expecting from the national picture, which is a potentially a historic Labour landslide. I think certainly a Labour landslide is putting it conservatively, but it's the nature of how large their majority is. And just on the racecourse, I've got the figures in front of me. So for the 58 constituencies under the new boundary changes that have a racecourse or two, there's various little anomalies in there. But roughly speaking, 38 of the 58 are Conservative, 10 are Labour. That's going to essentially flip on its head, going to best case scenario 17 Conservative after the election, based on YouGov's latest MRP on June 20th, but more likely 14 that you'd call safe Conservative seats. Labour potentially 29, a bit more conservatively 25 seats. So it's really an exact flip, not quite the sense that Labour won't have sort of 38 seats that represent racecourses, but there is a definite shift towards Labour, and also Lib Dems potentially making some pretty massive gains in those rural areas. So they're almost being flanked on both sides from a racing perspective.
So massive change in terms of the most, racing's direct link into Parliament. Some of our viewers might be listening to this and thinking, well, why does this matter?
Yeah, and a perfectly logical question. It matters because racing has relied quite heavily, I think, on some friendly ears in Parliament. It has direct links to some MPs with racecourses. You're thinking people like a Matt Hancock, who's been very vocal on affordability, and various others, George Freeman. There's a whole host of MPs who have put racing's case forward in a fairly direct way that perhaps other sports haven't enjoyed so obviously. So it almost needs to find some new friends in the new government. That's why it's significant, because it begs the question of, okay, the writing's been on the wall for a while with Labour coming in. What have you done to forge links there and create that dialogue with the incoming party, given the reliance that it has had on Conservative MPs to represent it?
Bill, there's a whole host of key issues that Westminster has control over or major say over, which impact racing, including gambling regulation, potentially intervening around welfare, immigration, tax rates. The list goes on. As John just said, racing enjoyed reasonably strong links with the Conservative administration, although some debate how effective they were in utilising them. But there's a sense that Labour does not have as many historic links with the sport, and that perhaps racing has not been as forward-thinking as it could have been in forging those links. What do we anticipate from a Labour government?
Well, yes, following on from John's piece, I've got an article going in Tuesday's edition on this. Racing is pretty much Conservative with both the small and capital C, you'd say. And the conversations I've had with certain people in racing have had a certain degree of trepidation about a Labour government, and also uncertainty about quite where they stand on things. Having spoken to a number of people for what the Labour government might mean, the sort of message I'm getting is that Labour isn't going to be sort of an anti racing. It's just not going to be very high on their list of priorities. Once they get into power, things like potholes in the road and mortgage rates and things like that, that's going to be their main priority. Now, I know racing would like the levy negotiations, which were brought to an abrupt halt when the election was called to be, you know, one of the first things that the Department for Culture, Media and Sport under a Labour administration gets on with. But chances are that's not going to be the case, I don't think.
I wouldn't have thought so anyway. So basically, racing's just going to have to join the queue of people wanting to put their case to a Labour government,
and it's going to have to come up with a convincing case built around its contribution to jobs, its contribution to sort of soft power, and international relations, things like that. So certainly in the short term, I don't see Labour being, you know, overly interventionist with racing. It might be, however, that, you know, with a second term, they might look at things.
One of the key areas right now, of course, is what's going to happen with affordability checks.
Yes.
You know, we've obviously touched on them at the top of the show as a key contributor to the ongoing decline in betting turnover. Enormous amount of friction put into the market, with tens of thousands of punters getting caught up in affordability checks. The Gambling Commission are due to launch in August a pilot on the proposed frictionless checks. That's obviously going to conclude under a Labour administration. Do we anticipate any change in emphasis or direction under Labour in terms of how affordability checks unfold from here?
I've not really heard anything. People just think basically Labour have been broadly supportive of the measures in the white paper, and given how long that's taken to get to where it is, and the other priorities that a Labour government will have, I would imagine, my guess would be that they'll just let that process go through. One potential thing that could change that is this new gambling survey for Great Britain that the Gambling Commission is going to publish later this month. And that potentially, although the Gambling Commission will play this down, have a much higher problem gambling rate. Now that might reignite the debate about gambling, and that might, you know, once this pilot is finished, possibly in February next year, that the pressure on the thresholds involved in affordability checks, that you could see that being an issue if the debate reignites. The one thing that I did think that might come out of the gambling review that might get revisited is gambling advertising, and that's another issue that could affect racing, in that the white paper basically didn't really touch gambling advertising. I could definitely see that a Labour government looking at gambling sponsorship, gambling marketing, gambling advertising, and if racing doesn't get a carve out for certainly TV advertising during the day, that could have ramifications for the sport, serious ramifications for the sport.
Just staying with the Gambling Commission for one second, you had a really important story in I think it was Monday's edition last week, about the Gambling Commission survey they ran, I think in 2021, was
That's
it?
That's right.
Asking punters about affordability checks. They never released it. They said they would release it alongside the consultation response to affordability checks, but instead released a sort of very anodyne description of it, saying that many punters wanted to see new protections, but some people expressed concerns about privacy and so forth. What did the data actually say? This obviously came up, freedom of information request by Regulus Partners, yes, gambling industry analysts. What did it actually say?
I mean, it basically showed the opposition of members of the public to the idea of affordability checks. It was 77% said they didn't think that 77% of how many it was. I mean, the 12,000 people responded to the survey, and it was 77% said that they didn't think that this was an appropriate thing. Only 14% said that they would willingly submit documents, and this survey was concluded in 2021. The Select Committee, the Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee, the following year questioned Andrew Rhodes, saying, why haven't you released this information? It's of public interest. Andrew Rhodes, who wasn't around at the time that the survey was completed, said, well, we'll look into it, but it's all wrapped into the white paper, but we will publish. I've written my column, new column, in tomorrow's edition. I was at the Betting and Gaming Council annual meeting earlier this year when Andrew Rhodes stood up and said, not only will we be releasing our gambling consultation response, but we will be releasing the... And because I'm sick of being asked, we will be releasing these figures. And he said, yes, write that down, Bill, is what he said. So I did, and I remember it clearly. And but unfortunately, when the consultation from last year, when that was released, as you say, they didn't release the figures. They released a sort of a summary of it, which didn't really set out quite how much opposition there was. And this is important because this information should have been out there and informing the debate around the white paper, and it wasn't. And you don't have to be overly cynical to think, well, these figures were inconvenient for them.
And for 12,000 punters who took the time to fill out the survey, the sneaking suspicion that their views were...
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, not being taken into account.
John, before we leave behind with a sigh of relief all the political business, we have to give a mention to the fact that betting has actually formed quite a key part of this election campaign, because we've had what has been tiresomely described as Gamblegate, whereby a series of Conservative officials and candidates are alleged to have placed bets on the timing of the election, possibly knowing exactly when it was going to be. A great big scandal has erupted. Some people saying politicians shouldn't be allowed to bet, some people using it as a stick to be betting with as a whole. But Keir Starmer came out and he said, I don't believe we need any new restrictions, which I thought was very promising. Politician saying no restrictions on gambling, albeit a very specific case. And I only bet on the horses. Keir Starmer, I only bet on the horses. So there we go.
Great result. Yeah, coming out of Gamblegate. I quite like Gamblegate myself. yeah, it's been a very fascinating little sort of tread, something to follow during the election build up. And yeah, it's put gambling in the headlines for the wrong reasons, perhaps. But Sir Keir Starmer coming out and saying that is very promising indeed. And the fact that he's a lot's made of the fact that he's attended race meetings and his wife's a big lover of racing, and we sort of lean on those things as trying to give us an inkling as to how Labour might, or Labour politicians might, approach racing. So for him to come out and say that he only backs horses has to be a positive.
There we go. That is a wrap on all things politics. As Bill just mentioned there, he's got a new column beginning in tomorrow's newspaper, that's Tuesday's newspaper, or online Monday afternoon for members. It's called On The Money. Bill Barber is our industry editor. He's the best connected person in racing, and just about the only person who understands this infuriating, crazy sport with its mad structure. So you have to read Bill's new column if you want to understand racing. On The Money in Tuesday's Racing Post, or for members online. And if you want to learn more about Members Club, we've got a short advert now.
Get 50% off your first 3 months in the Racing Post Members Club. As a member, you get access to the digital newspaper exclusively available to members the night before. You'll get daily tips on the likes of Pricewise, Tom Siegel, Robbie Wilders and Paul Keighley. Enjoy award-winning journalism from the industry's best writers and watch replays from all British and Irish racing, now available within the Racing Post app. Subscribe today and get 50% off your first 3 months membership.
Welcome back. And that's politics done. Let's turn to the horse racing, thank God. Well, first of all, we had a few big stories last week. Let's deal with them in roughly chronological order. Because first of all, we had Betfred announcing they were going to sponsor the Guineas recently vacated by Kipco, meaning that Betfred have all five classics under their banner. And Fred Doan, the veteran gambling industry operator, is a remarkable return to the fold in racing after just a short time ago. He and the sport fell out in a very public fashion over the tote.
Yes, absolutely. Your interview you did, I think, about 7 years ago when he said that racing and
I are going to have to get along without each other.
Did not know I did that.
It was yours. So there we go. But yes, it is quite a remarkable turnaround. And you know, Betfred being the first company to sponsor all five classics is pretty noteworthy. I suppose there will be people who think, well, you know, the fact that a bookmaker is sponsoring all five classics is worrying that the sport can't reach outside. It might be, however, that it's a reflection of, you know, the captains of industry in Britain and the UK are no longer perhaps racing fans or can't get it past their boards to do these sponsorships. I mean, the sponsorships of the Derby going back were all the chairs and chief executives are all sort of racehorse owners. So but there's a slight worry there, but it's good that, you know, that we've got the Guineas being sponsored. There was a very short sort of hiatus where they were going to be unsponsored.
Yeah.
So we've Betfred coming in, and then of course they've put up this bonus for the £2 million bonus for the triple crown as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, not been won since Nijinsky, and very few have actually really tried laterally.
Yes.
Of course, pretty much Coolmore, the only racing operation that very obviously wants to, record a triple crown winner. But hopefully, this £2 million bonus will incentivize a few more to think about having a pop at something that hasn't been won for a very long time.
Yeah, it's. Fred Doane is one of the shrewder operators out there, and he no doubt will have seen that apart from Nijinsky, the previous Colts Triple Crown winner was 1935. So there's not been that many who've attempted it. Nashuan didn't get to the ledger. See the Stars didn't get to the ledger. I suppose Reference Point won the Derby and the ledger, but didn't make the Guineas. But yeah, it's not. I mean, being an old fogey. And having got into racing not that long, really, after Nijinsky won the Triple Crown, it's something that I'd love to see. Not quite. I've got a feeling I'll be waiting quite a long time, but you never know.
You never know. We also had the Irish Derby at the Curragh on Sunday, John. First of all, a lot of debate around the race before and after about the standing it has in the pattern. I think it's dropped down to 160 something in the world in terms of ratings, and people asking whether it should be dropped in distance to the French Derby distance of a mile two.
Yeah, that's a hot division, that middle distance top level races with the classic pattern in Europe, and it's competing with some very big races, obviously, naturally, with the King George and the Derby itself. And there's so many options now for those, what we call the top horses, to use a bit of a punditry cliche, adding in tops, but the upper echelon, as it were. It could do with a really vintage running, I think. I'm not sure this was it, but it could do with a really good winner. And as for dropping it down in trip, I suppose you've then got the Coral Eclipse comes into the equation as another option, so you're almost going out of one competitive field into another. But it was a good race, I thought, with Los Angeles being a good winner. I thought he ran fantastically in the Derby for such a massive horse, and we always felt like the Irish Derby would suit, and it absolutely did. Ryan Moore again, up the rail, perfect.
And four Coolmore horses in there. Partly in order to make sure the field got to eight, not a great sign of health, but
no.
They probably used those horses quite wisely, didn't they?
I would say so, yes. It did, having looked at the head-on, that Los Angeles certainly got a better passage through than Ambiente Friendly.
Prior day at the Curragh, we had the Pretty Polly, won by Blue Stocking. Kieran Schumark, the hunt for Group 1 goes on in his new job.
Yes, I feel a bit sorry for him, really. Every sort of week that goes by, sort of the pressure ratchets up. But yes, I'd quite like to see him.
Hit 1.03 and running on Betfair on Emily Upjohn.
No, I'd like to see him get that winner and get the monkey off his back and just be able to, just get on with it. Get on with his job, really.
I'd imagine more people are talking about it outside than they are inside. I think around him there won't be the same level of, I'm sure he feels it, I'm sure he's desperate to do it, but he's a Group 1 winning jockey already, which people almost forget a little bit. And I likened him to Thierry Henry in his hunt for a first Arsenal goal a while back. And when I wrote that, I thought it's only a matter of time. And this did feel like a very good opportunity, but I'm fairly sure there will be others.
It will come. Finally, we've already mentioned the Coral Eclipse, building up to Saturday. Big sporting day, of course. England in action, I think kicking off 10 minutes after the last race at Sandown. But the highlight for us on that day is going to be City of Troy going in the Coral Eclipse.
Yeah, can't wait. I mean, after his redemption at Epsom, after his blowout in the Guineas, he's just... Flat racing relies quite heavily, I think, on those one or two big horses a season, the likes of Baid, and City of Troy is definitely in that bracket, even though he has lost his certain air of invincibility at Newmarket. It's just a question of how high he can go now, hopefully. I really do hope he follows it up from a strictly a sporting sense, because we could really do with him being a kind of, you know, the one that we hang this flat season on.
It'll be fascinating to see if he continues to follow in the footsteps of his older stablemate, Auguste Rodin, in turning in highly inconsistent performances, top level one day and dismal the next.
Gives us something to write about, doesn't it? You know, and I quite like that little, the Auguste Rodin roller coaster is quite fun to follow, I think. So he doesn't seem to be the same type of horse, but purely on the limited evidence that we have. But we'll find out at the weekend, won't we?
Absolutely. We'll find out a lot over the next 7 days. Will England continue at Euro 2024? How big is the Labour landslide going to be? And is City of Troy the superstar we all hope he is? We'll discuss all of those things on this show next week. But for this week, that's a wrap. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you to my guests, Bill Barber and Jonathan Harding. And we'll see you very soon.